I'm going to read a rather long quote to lead into today's conversation, so bear with me, if you will. Here's the quote. I have come to believe that today, our society as a whole finds itself in a crisis. We can read about its numerous manifestations every day in the newspaper. We have high inflation and unemployment. We have an energy crisis, a crisis in health care, pollution and other environmental disasters, a rising wave of violence and crime, and so on. The basic thesis of the book he was writing is that these are all different facets of one and the same crisis, and that this crisis is essentially a crisis of perception. It derives from the fact that we are trying to apply the concepts of an outdated worldview, the mechanistic worldview of Cartesian, Newtonian science, to a reality that can no longer be understood in terms of these concepts. We live today in a globally interconnected world in which biological, psychological, social, and environmental phenomena are all interdependent. To describe this world appropriately, we need an ecological perspective, which the Cartesian worldview does not offer. What we need, then, is a new paradigm, a new vision of reality, a fundamental change in our thoughts, perceptions, and values. Now, any of you who listen to the show on a regular basis know I agree with that quote. Now, first of all, those are the words of today's guest, Fritjof Capra. But the amazing thing is that they were written in 1981 in the preface to his book, The Turning Point. The Turning Point, I believe, is a remarkable book. I've read it more than once, and I've given it as a present several times. And we'll talk today about the power of worldviews and why so little has changed in 27 years. Fritjof Capra has a new book out, The Science of Leonardo, and we'll talk about that as well. He says that most authors who have discussed the science of Leonardo da Vinci, the great master painter and genius of the Renaissance, have examined it through a Newtonian lens. And according to him, this has prevented them from understanding its essential nature, which he believes is radically different from the mechanistic science of those other giants, Galileo, Descartes, and Newton. Fritjof Capra is a founding director of the Center for Ecoliteracy in Berkeley, California, which promotes ecology and systems thinking in primary and secondary education. He's on the faculty of Schumacher College, an international center for ecological studies in England, and he's the author of several bestsellers, including The Tao of Physics and The Turning Point. He also co-authored Green Politics and co-edited Steering Business Towards Sustainability. And his most recent book is the one that's just out, The Science of Leonardo. Welcome, Fritjof Capra.
Thank you for having me on your show.
It's great to have you. As I think I said before we went on air, I've obviously, that book came out in 81, and as I said, I've read it more than once and actually have given, it's a rather thick book, but I've given it to people and said, here, this says a lot of what needs to be said, and have followed your thinking over the years, so it's really my pleasure as well when I saw you were going to be in town. So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work. When we start off, so let me ask you, how did a mild-mannered physicist become the author of books about worldviews and paradigm change?
Well, it all began with my interest in philosophy. My father was a lawyer, but very well-read and very interested in philosophy. And at home, we had a large library of philosophers. My mother was a poet. And both my parents were very interested in art and, you know, dragged my brother and me through all the museums in Italy when we were around 10 or 12. And so when I became a scientist and studied physics in Vienna, immediately I was interested in the philosophy of science. And I was very influenced by a book by Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of atomic physics, quantum physics. The book is called Physics and Philosophy, and it's now a classic. And Heisenberg describes in it how those physicists struggled with a new worldview that was emerging in physics with experiments that were totally mysterious at first and led them into radically new concepts. And that book stayed with me through my studies, and then came the 60s. I got interested in Eastern philosophy. George Harrison went to India, brought back a sitar, you know, and all these things worked together. And so I also became interested in the social movements in the 60s. I was in Paris in May 68. I was in Berkeley shortly after that. And all that eventually, you know, is reflected in my books. But first I explored the sort of expansion of consciousness into the spiritual spiritual, the religious, the mystical, and that's the Tao of physics. And then I explored the expansion of consciousness into the social realm, the social, questioning authority in many, many fields. You know, the kind of work that is now institutionalized here at KPFK.
Exactly.
But which was radical and in living rooms and kitchens and grassroots movements in the 60s. And so, in the turning point, I made this diagnosis, which you read, which I think, for better or worse, is still very valid, you know, in a sense, unfortunately. Now, the new paradigm, especially in science, but also in society, has progressed enormously. And I wrote a couple of books in between The Web of Life and The Hidden Connections, in which I really outline the systems view of life that is now rather complete, with a biological dimension, a cognitive dimension in the whole field of cognitive science, and a social dimension.
When you said, in these intervening years, as you present in those later books, and they're The Web of Life and The Hidden Connections, right?
Right.
I've also read both of them. You say the systems view of life has now been more rounded out and filled out.
And formalized,
through actual discoveries and work, or just better articulation?
Both, but a lot of discoveries. A key development came in the late 70s and early 80s with complexity theory, which is technically known as nonlinear dynamics. Now we have a mathematical language to describe nonlinear systems. Now, you may ask, what are nonlinear systems? Basically, everything you're interested in. The economy is a nonlinear, and they're all living systems, right?
Exactly.
And that's why they are nonlinear. And this connection between life and nonlinear mathematically, if you want to describe it mathematically, was the big breakthrough around 1980.
So, in other words, a couple of things I want to respond to that. One is that when you wrote the book, The Tao of Physics, and the book, The Turning Point, and so you mentioned that you worked on The Turning Point for 6 years, so a lot of time you're working on that. This field hasn't really fleshed itself out yet. You're writing about something which calls for complexity theory before complexity theory has been articulated.
And I sort of cobbled together a chapter which I called The Systems View of Life. I sort of took things from all parts, but it's not a coherent theory. Now, 20 years later, I could write The Hidden Connections, where this synthesis that I'm now proposing is much more coherent and much more founded on actual science.
Okay, very good. The other thing I was going to say is, let's go to this question, and it's one of the big questions that I've been asking for many years, which is, I will state to people, preface, reality is not dead, mechanical, or separate, but reality is alive, evolving, and composed of interdependent systems.
Absolutely.
And I, when I've had Kenny Ausubel of the Bioneers, I say that's basically the premise of the Bioneers conferences,
right,
isn't it?
Right.
So I believe that such a worldview has been shared by indigenous peoples for millennia. It's been revealed by science since early in the 20th century. And now, not in its fullness, as you just pointed out. It's obvious to me every time you walk outside the door, look at the sky, look into the eyes of a living being. How do we explain the hypnotic hold of the mechanical worldview on people in power, let's say, or on the prevailing culture?
Well, I would guess it is through the connection between science and technology, because the mechanistic Newtonian science was the theoretical background of the Industrial Revolution, and it allowed people to design wonderful machines, from the steam engine on to, you know, the automobile. And, you know, most of the machines we're using now, today, actually require quantum theory to explain the physics that underlies.
I understand. And, in other words, driving a modern car, you're driving a computer on wheels, basically.
That's right, yeah. Driving a Prius, by the way, which is a great car.
Which we both drive, I assume.
Yeah.
Definitely, that one is a computer. You can't get that fixed elsewhere. Yeah. So what you're saying is that most of the machines that were the industrial age, and am I correct, most of the social systems that were the industrial age were based on that mechanical model.
That's right. You see, Newton's mechanics was the sort of model for everything, for all the sciences, and for many things where it's inappropriate, like medicine, for instance, or, you know, social science, economics, management. You know, a company is not a machine, and a community is not a machine. The human body is not a machine, but that was assumed. And people went quite far with
God as the great clockmaker in
That's
the sky, right.
Right?
So when I asked, how do you explain the hypnotic hold, in other words, that people still want to function that way, I think if one looks at even American politics, American foreign policy under Bush, there's a lot of hierarchy and mechanist.
Yes, and linear thinking. You know, in Newtonian science, in the mechanistic paradigm, if you want to explain something, and Descartes actually was the founder of this strategy. If you want to explain something, you reduce it to the smallest components and you try with the mechanisms that interconnect them to explain the whole. You don't make connections to other wholes. Now, let's take ecology or biology as a whole as an example. If you go out in the forest and see a bird with red feathers and you want to explain this scientifically, you don't decompose the feathers. That doesn't, you know, you can look at the pigment and that's one reason why they are red. But, you know, why did nature come up with red feathers? You have to relate the bird to its environment, to its habitat, to its history. That's ecological thinking and it's systemic thinking. You have to connect the dots, as we say in a popular parlance. And this is a singular lack in our politicians, not just Bush, but, you know, all our political or most of our political and corporate leaders do not know how to connect the dots. So they go to Iraq to fight a war that bleeds the country to get oil that we don't even need because we have other means of energy now. If we had spent a fraction of that money developing conservation,
I believe it's up
alternative
to
two, sources.
I believe it's up to $2 or $3 billion a week right
now.
Yeah. And had we spent, as you say, a fraction of what we spent in Iraq developing renewable energy, we'd have done a service to the whole world.
Yes, and we would have prevented this rise of global warming, of global climate change because of, you know, the greenhouse gases.
And you can bet oil wouldn't be costing $100 a barrel if suddenly it had competition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if we fed the children in our schools organically grown food, we wouldn't have the crisis of obesity, we wouldn't poison the farm workers. And again, the organically grown food in an organic soil needs a lot of carbon because carbon is the chemical backbone of life. And where do these worms and bacteria take the carbon from? Well, from the air. They draw it down. Therefore, a carbon sink, again, you know, fighting global climate change through organic food in our schools. Well, that's connecting the dots. That's systemic thinking.
That's right. That's reality is alive and interdependent. By the way, I've had Ann Cooper on. Are you familiar with her? She runs the nutrition program in the Berkeley School District,
yes.
Which now is not only providing kids organic food, but teaching them about...
That's right. At the Center for Ecoliteracy, we are very much involved in this
Yeah, this I wanted program. To ask you about that, and so since you just brought it up, I will. What was it when it started, and what do you feel you've accomplished over the years? Because you've been there a long time.
Yeah, over 10 years, about 12 years. Well, its mission is to promote ecological thinking, the science of ecology, and systemic thinking in schools.
And let me say to people, if you've been following this conversation, when he says ecology, he doesn't mean something about the environment. Ecology is about the interweaving of all of life.
Yes, and it includes, of course, the environment.
Yeah.
So we take kids out into gardens, into school gardens, and have them experience ecology with the hands in the earth, the change of the season, the cycle of growth and decay of plants. They cook meals in schools. They go out and visit farms. They go to farmers markets. So it's a whole program like this, which has grown tremendously, and it's always linked to curriculum. So what they learn in the classroom refers to what they learn in the garden, and vice versa.
And if people want to learn more about that, that's...
There's a link on my website to the Center for Ecoliteracy, and the website there is ecoliteracy.org.
Okay, ecoliteracy, one word, .org. Is some of that work available beyond Berkeley? Is it, have you spread it to school
yes.
systems around the country?
Yes, because we are now teaching seminars and people come from all over the country and they do things in other schools. They actually come from all over the world. With the internet now, with our website, which is very extensive, we announce our seminars and we get participants from Brazil, from Norway, from Australia. It's absolutely fantastic.
That's very exciting. Let me mention one other thing. We've talked about it generally. The thing that most struck me about the turning point, besides the worldview, was that you, as you sort of briefly did just there, there's a section in there where you look at how that old worldview sort of hinders us in various arenas and how a new worldview could help us.
Right.
And you look at health and medicine. You look at agriculture. You look at business and economics. You look at energy and environment. Two questions. One, first, could you just like, maybe speak about agriculture, okay, just for a bit. Second, have you thought of updating that book? Because it seems to me that is the reason that I've given it as a gift is I say, here's how to look at the big picture.
Well, in a sense, The Hidden Connections, which was published in 2002, is the 21st century version of The Turning Point. You see, at The Turning Point, as you said, I looked at biology, I looked at medicine, I looked at economics, but in The Hidden Connections, I look at life.
Okay.
Because that's what they have in common. And I integrate the biological dimensions of life with the cognitive dimensions and the social dimensions. And I again look at all these sciences, but from an integrative point of view. Now, the historical section is still very valid in The Turning Point. And there, my big new discovery is that this systemic thinking, this relating everything to life, this seeing the earth as alive, was really founded by Leonardo da Vinci. That's why he's so important.
Okay.
It's not only fascinating to study him as a Renaissance genius, but he's tremendously relevant for our time.
How did you happen to make that discovery? What led you back to look at Leonardo's science, and then what did it tell you?
Well, I had been fascinated by Leonardo since the 1970s when I wrote The Tao of Physics. I came across a statement that he wrote where he defines his empirical method, that he will observe nature and then draw conclusions and use reasoning to see why nature acts in a certain way. That's what we now call the scientific method. He also used mathematics. He also used theoretical models. And ever since that time, I thought he should really be interpreted from the point of view of our modern science of life, our complexity theory. And it took me 20, 30 years to get around to doing
it. Right. I think you even say that you have a quote from him early in the Tao of Physics, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And that's now the epitaph of the new book. Now what was the second part?
The second question is, so what, how far ahead of his time was he in terms of his use of, if not his definition of, the scientific method?
Well, Leonardo lived 100 years before Galileo, and he single-handedly created this empirical approach that we now call the scientific method.
What were people doing prior to that?
Well, knowledge was transmitted from the Greek philosophers. Science did not exist, not even the word science in our sense. It was called natural philosophy. And those were speculations that were transmitted from philosopher to philosopher, were never checked empirically. And then in the Middle Ages were fused with Christian doctrine and used as the official creed. And any questioning of Aristotle's thought was heretical. You see,
what you're saying, in case people didn't follow that, is that the church, which was the power broker on how people thought in the Western world, went back to the Greeks, merged it with their Christian or religious teaching, and said, this is reality.
Yes, absolutely.
And so in other words, questioning Aristotle was the same as questioning Jesus.
Yes, yes. And of course, that's where Galileo came to suffer. And 100 years earlier, Leonardo kept his findings secret.
For that reason?
For other reasons too, but also largely for that reason. And unfortunately, his voluminous notebooks, 13,000 pages when he died, were lost and hidden for centuries and were not really analyzed until the 19th century. This is why Leonardo had no direct influence on science.
What you're saying is he preceded it, but didn't necessarily
Didn't inform it. But there's a sort of a virtual lineage from Leonardo da Vinci to Johann Wolfgang von Goethe in Germany, the poet and scientist, to Gregory Bateson, the cyberneticist and systems theorist, to Prigozhin, Maturana, Varela, all the people that I have written about, Lynn Margulis, the Gaia hypothesis, Gaia theory. All this is a lineage of which Leonardo stands at the beginning.
Now that's an interesting phenomenon, and let me ask you what you say about that.
His discoveries were rediscovered independently some 200 years later, some 300 years later, some even only in the 20th century. His anatomy of the heart contains details that people are now verifying with computer models. I mean, absolutely incredible.
So you said that one of the keystones, and by the way, I'm speaking with Fritjof Capra about his new book, The Science of Leonardo. Fritjof is the author over the years of The Tao of Physics and The Turning Point and so on. His method, you said, was empirical.
Yes.
And so how does he...
Was it
cadavers or was it imagination?
No. It was experiments, observations in botany, in geology, in the science that is now called fluid dynamics or hydrodynamics, which he was the first to really create. In many, many fields, it was empirical and it was systematic scientific thinking. But the big thing that other authors have not realized before is that he must be compared to Galileo in terms of method, but not in terms of content. Because Leonardo's science was not mechanistic, it was a science of life, it was a science of systemic thought, a science of living forms that were always transforming themselves, always in development, very much like our systems and complexity theories today.
And were there others through the years who saw things that way, or was he...
Yes, there were others. There was a whole movement called Romantic Biology in Germany, then it moved to England, and a whole series of biologists who focused on organic forms, on the nature of biological form. That influenced Darwin in his early work. So all this, but again, you know, Leonardo was not a direct influence,
right,
but it was rediscovered. And then the whole field of systems theory, cybernetics, and, you know, modern studies of what is now called morphology, a term actually created in the 18th century by Goethe, the study of biological form. All these virtually are sort of in the lineage that starts with Leonardo.
Now, when he is seeing things that way, and then later people are seeing things that way, we've spoken about it a little earlier in the conversation, but the fact that the Newtonian understanding, the mechanical understanding, had such power in the world.
Yes.
In other words, you could build a machine
yes.
and move a mountain.
Yes.
That gave it a power in the mind, didn't
yes,
it?
Yes, but you see, there is where Leonardo is really unique. There have been other geniuses in history of humankind, but this is where Leonardo is unique because, as is well known and widely known, he was a mechanical genius. He was a
That's
genius
right.
inventor. He's known for his machines, right?
That's right,
much more than his science. And so this is a very subtle thought. He was a mechanical genius, but his worldview was not mechanistic. And in fact, very beautifully, he saw mechanics as a very noble science because, he says, nature has given mechanical instruments to animals because otherwise they couldn't move. And I'm going to study those mechanical instruments, he says. And so he studies mechanics for years and years in order to understand the movement of living bodies. So mechanics is subservient as a science to the life sciences, rather than saying living organisms are machines and therefore mechanics is at the top. It was just the opposite.
So he was a true synthesizer and a true,
yes.
had an integral
Absolutely.
View,
Absolutely.
Which we have now waited hundreds of years
yes.
to
yes.
gain some power
and,
again.
And in addition, his science was infused with the very deep ethics, a love of nature, a special compassion for animals. He always took nature as his mentor and model in his designs. So he was an eco-designer, if you wish. And this is, again, why he's so relevant for our time.
Right. You wrote a book with Stendhal Rast, and we've only got about a minute. You wrote a book with Stendhal Rast called Belonging in the Universe?
Yes.
In which you reconcile modern religion and modern science, about which this great argument going on today. It sounds like Leonardo himself kind of embodied that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. In his deep ecological awareness and his great reverence for life. That comes through his whole science.
Why would you recommend someone read this book?
Well, if you're interested in the history of Western thought, if you're interested in the Renaissance, if you're interested in the synthesis of art and science, and if you're interested in one of the greatest minds that ever lived, then read the book.
And also, it seems to me, one other thing is that you can see someone who saw what is so before the cloud of that mechanical worldview covered it. And maybe for even us, it's a way
absolutely.
To see the whole in a way we haven't before.
Yes.
So again, the book is The Science of Leonardo. The earlier books, which I highly recommend as well, include The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, and The Web of Life. The website is FritjofCapra.net. That's FritjofCapra.net. Thank you, Fritjof Capra, and keep
Thank
up
you.
The good work.
It was a pleasure.
It
Thanks
really
so much,
was.
Jerry.
Thanks a lot.